Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert, from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to rugby legend Johnny Wilkinson, and the theme is obsession. Johnny Wilkinson, how are you?
Great, thank you. Yeah, really pleased to be here, and life's great.
Delighted to have you on Don't Tell Me the Score. Real thrill for me, this. Now, you and I have got quite a lot in common. First of all, we are both above average number 10s in our pomp.
Okay.
We share an interest in non-duality, which we will touch on without going too deep. We both like Arnie Schwarzenegger back in the day.
Nice, yeah.
And fermenting.
Right.
I actually have listeners get in touch with me and ask about like how to make kefir and stuff like that, because I bang the kefir drum, right? And I've got... That is a little pot of homemade milk kefir with chia seeds, banana and blueberry. I will offer it to Johnny. I don't think he's going to actually take me up on it. And you are a mad fermenter as well, right?
Yeah, probably about sort of seven, eight years ago now, I started to get very interested in what I've seen around the rugby change rooms in terms of the nutrition. It was so scientific, and I was sort of moving down a much more holistic, earthy route, if you like. I sort of started to think, well, what can be done? I started to explore that. And at the same time, I was very hugely invested in a mental health journey. And so that was the route I was going down. My wife, a bit later on, started training to become a nutritionist. And we ended up meeting on a certain path where she came home and sort of said, about fermenting. She started to get interested in this. And I started to explore the idea about its effects, sort of mental health on the gut, brain, everything. And so we went for it. And since then, it's been a journey of huge exploration. Now I'm sort of officially in the market as a provider of fermented drinks in specific kombucha.
So you were looking at it from a mental health point of view sort of 7-8 years ago. So what benefits then have you noticed?
I think for me personally, going through a purely experiential sort of response to that, it would be just feeling more alive and bright during the day. There isn't the lulls, the ups and down lulls, it's just a sense of clarity. Definitely from a digestion perspective, I'm sort of much more aligned, I feel. And as a result, I don't have any of the issues I really remember having. But I've also changed the rest of my diet. So it always, like I said, it will work as part of a global systemic thing. It's not just a kind of, well, keep waking up at this time and stressing your head off, but just drink this and you'll be fine. It's just, it's part of a bigger picture for me, but it's been a huge part.
Right. The name of your company is Number One, and you've talked about it being one pillar of well-being, generally speaking. So that's why you came up with the name Number One, right?
Number One was quite a personal thing. In everything that I've tried to do in my life, I've wanted to be, I want it to be the best it can possibly be. I want it to be the number one. I want to go out there to make it number one. But the aim always was, and I'm not sure we'll ever get there, was at some point to also reveal that when you remove the dot, it then becomes no one. And the idea, therefore, being that being number one is a great ambition, but to never forget that it doesn't make you someone. You're still no one. And this was an amazing thing for me to understand that, yes, go out there and be number one as an ambition, as a strive, and see what you can do with your life and see what you can achieve. But understand underneath it all, it doesn't make you someone any more important. And that self-importance and that self-centeredness was always and has always been at the very center, has been the crux or the hub of all my mental health journey, has been revealing that that was the issue. And so it was this great journey between saying, yeah, we're going out there to make it incredible, but we're going out there to make it incredible by understanding that who we are is incredible, but not any more incredible than anyone else. And no one's special, and therefore you can make everything you do the number one thing in your life.
I think that's fantastic. So number one and no one. Now that sums up, I would say, to some degree, your journey.
Yeah, I think number one going out there is about performance. And I've understood from my life, my exploration, that if I look at how I am when I'm performing at my best, it doesn't feel stressed or satisfied or proud. It feels effortless. It feels connected. And as a result, I then look at what I feel like when I'm trying to be someone in the change room 2 minutes before a game, and you're stressed out your mind, you're struggling, you fear failure, and you just want to know how everything turns out. And you go to that space about being no one and you're exploring. And so it was this fabulous line between exploring in performance and not trying to control, and exploring who you are and realizing that there's nothing there. And it was that kind of, for me, that's the journey, is understanding that performance and about being everything you can be comes from, on the outside, comes from realizing that you're no one on the inside.
Let's illustrate this then with your story, right? So 8 years old, Farnham RFC. I was Isha, by the way.
All right, okay. Thank you guys.
Yeah, I remember. You were 8 years old and you wrote this list of things that you wanted to achieve.
Yeah.
One was be the kicker for England.
Yeah.
One was be the best in the world. And one was win a World Cup.
Yeah, there's a few more little ones in there about,
but those are three pretty salient ones.
Yeah.
And you ticked them all off.
Yeah.
So the essence of that, just to give a quick overview, was to be number one, to become number one, which you achieved.
Yeah.
And then you essentially, to some degree, realised that at the top of that mountain wasn't the satisfaction that you expected there to be.
Yeah.
And then that has led you down the other side of the mountain towards no one. Right. So that sums it up in a nutshell. So take us back then to when you were eight and you were that fixated and that obsessed, because you were obviously an obsessive character, particularly as a, you know, when you were a rugby player, that's well documented. So were you like that right from that age?
I still am now. I still am. It's part of, it's part of my internal drive and desire, which helps me in every single way. When I was young, I did set all these goals. I had a huge passion for rugby and for sport in general, for ultimately through the physical means of trying to see what I was capable of. That's how I did it. How I wanted to see I was capable of was a ball in my hand, whether it be a rugby ball that was a racket in my hand hitting balls, or whether it was a cricket bat, or whether it was anything to do with sport, basketball. I just went for it. There was a competitive side to that, because when I was doing it, you know, whenever you're competing, you want to win. And within that, you want to know how you can be a part of that win. I set my goals and I sort of went after it. But at the beginning, it was just pure passionate. I mean, literally, it was almost like, hand me a ball and you could see a marked difference in everything.
You just loved it.
Just a brightness, just an almost like an aura around yourself. You know, I could feel myself become bigger, connect it to life through that ball and that exploration of what I could do with it and how I could master it, I guess.
I have to just quick mention about being that eight. And one thing it does show is the benefit then of writing down goals, you know, because clearly in your case, I mean, there's a lot of talk about it. It did work.
Yeah, there's two ways looking at it. I guess you can definitely write them down and remind yourself of it. And it's a real commitment, a deeper commitment that you sort of almost holds you to your path. But at the same time, the reason I wrote them down was because I was so enthusiastic about it that on an evening when there was no balls to kick and no games to watch on TV, and my mum and dad had banned me from the bottom room where I'd rip the curtains down, diving around and doing all this, or kicking toilet rolls around as if they were rugby balls, you're left thinking, well, what can I do? So you get the pad out and start thinking. It's just an expression of that sheer desire and focus and intention. So in a way, yes, it was a great thing to hold me to my goals, but it also came about through just being single-mindedly focused on just exploring my passion in life.
Do you think that obsessive and single-mindedness was born of anything, or were you born that way?
I think it was, or it is, I think, part of something which came with me into this life, and something that therefore is from as early as I can remember. It's been it's been a sort of an internal push that's been in everything I do. It's often been in things that I haven't necessarily found that much passion in doing when I was younger. It's been a thing about getting the results. In the things I've had my passion in, it was about what can I do. Yeah. And what can I be with this? But yes, I think it's been there, and it's been the secret of everything. Without single-minded focus, I don't think anything really. Well, without committed action, things don't get done, and without the intention behind it. So when you intensify that and you refuse to let it go, I think things can happen. I think the journey. I'd always look back and think it's ridiculous how a journey can waver in so many ways. In terms of so many things seem to be, you know, not right or not what I expected, but that single-minded focus and desire brings everything back to a final point on that journey. And for me, that was the World Cup final. Whereas before that, there'd been so many ups and downs, which would tell you that it's not working, it's not happening. But by taking that next step, you can end up where you want to be, and who knows when it's going to be. But that for me was, you know, for it to end up at a World Cup final with a ball in your hand and someone, you know, saying the same words I said about myself in my back garden, you know, and oh, he drops the ball, he's going to drop the goal for the World Cup, and someone's saying it about you. It's funny how that comes about. But give me a, you know, 2 weeks earlier, I'd have been saying, oh, what a waste of time, you know, when we almost lose to Wales in the quarterfinal. Yeah. It's never going to happen. And a year before that, when we lose the Grand Slam game against whoever, Ireland, it's kind of like, oh, it's never going to happen. What's the point of this? But the thing is that it's the next step that counts, not the last one.
I mean, you virtually willed it into existence. A couple of things I want to say. First of all, that obsessiveness both is a driver and an incredibly positive thing, clearly, in your life, but has also been a challenge. A couple of other bits I want to say. Now, I imagine this would have made you squirm a little bit before, and I'm interested to see whether it still does. But I have to say, you're the first guest I've had on Don't Tell Me School who literally brought me to tears.
Right.
I was in Australia in 2003.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
oh,
wow. But I wasn't in the stadium. I was in Darling Harbour.
Right.
There was about 10 of us, and we were surrounded by Aussies. Dirty, yeah. Great screen.
Okay.
We used to do your...
Right, okay.
We used to do your...
Yeah,
your pose.
Yeah.
And we were, you know, we felt like we were under siege, but we held out. And then when that moment on... Because at that time, I think something that people forget is that, you know, England and Britain never won the big stuff. And I think now, I think that 2003 moment has set a lot of British sport up, because it got rid of that kind of we can't do it moment. You know, all the successes that followed, that win in 2003 kind of, to me, kickstarted everything that followed. And I couldn't believe it. I remember I rang from Sydney, left a, you know, sweary message on my mum's answer phone.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe we'd done it. So that sort of teed everything up. But let's go back a little bit, though, to your England debut. Also there. I was there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I remember when you came on the wing.
I was
just above you. You were down below me on the left-hand side. So that was it. So England debut, 1998, against Ireland. Obviously, you're a winger. I mean, crikey, what the hell were they thinking there?
I asked myself the same question.
No offence.
No, I remember warming up in the England goal line with about sort of 10 minutes to go, or 5 minutes to go, whatever it was. And we were dropping like flies in the back line. And I remember Mike Catt got injured. and myself and Scott Benton, I think it was, a scrum half, were on the bench, and they started calling me over to get warmed up. And I was looking around thinking, yeah, but where am I going to go? And I was trying to point to Scott Benton, say, you know, he's quicker than me, what are you doing? And they said, you're going on the wing. Oh, geez, this is how I pictured my first international cap, was not on the wing. And as soon as I went on, I sort of thought, well, what can you do? You know, just take the next moment as it comes. And as it was, straight away, they put a box kick on me. Yeah.
And you took it?
I took it. It was a bit long, so I had a bit more time than they wanted me to have. But also, at the same time, we were penalised because I had more time because Neil Back was basically cheating. Neil Back had blocked one of their runners, so right. I had more time. But he got penalised for it. But it was a good way to start the game, get into it straight away. But also, it was just a great moment. I think I'd been on the bench the week before and not come on, and that was the last game of the Five Nations that year. And if I'd missed that one, I'd have then been, yeah. So to get a chance for that time, who knows? You know how important that became in terms of the next step. But it was a very sort of life changing moment. Definitely.
Yeah, and an odd debut, and then obviously you very quickly established yourself in the England team. The tour of hell that you went on, so where England got pretty much battered, didn't they? How formative and actually valuable an experience was that?
If you'd have asked me at various times during my life, I'd have given you different answers. All of them to do with this idea about, you know, without challenge, there can't be change, or, you know, you need to, all this for improvement and everything. But from my position now, how do I look at it? It's a straightforward understanding of the infinite capacity to accept, despite all the things beforehand. You're thinking, you know, in myself at that time was built by these ideas of what I could never deal with, and they were the things I tried to keep out, you know, by controlling my life, such as I could never deal with, whether it be being sent off or letting my family down, all these kind of ideas I had at that time, and one of them would have been being humiliated on a rugby field, or whatever humiliation meant at that time. And then it happens, and you sat around the changing room going, this shouldn't be happening, and I can't bear it. And it's everything I never wanted to happen. Yeah, this is the young kid who always did this and always did this, and this isn't right.
So there's the resistance to
it. There's huge resistance, but then the understanding comes from that experience that, well, you can accept it because you do accept it, because you move on. And as a result, it was a huge barrier that came down, not because suddenly I, you know, the day after I woke up enlightened saying, well, hold on, I know I can do this now, because no, I didn't. It took me a while to get over it, but it doesn't matter how long it took. The point is that whatever I thought I couldn't accept, I did. And I was able eventually to respond how I wanted and in a more powerful way. Now, over time and over the experience, what's happened is that time has become shorter for me to a space where it's much more instantaneous. The accepting and the responding is the same moment. Whereas then it was huge resistance for 6 months, 9 months, a year, whatever it took me to fully get over that. And then you eventually move on and start getting on with it. But now that time comes down. I think for a lot of the guys in that World Cup team, we'd then gone through all the Grand Slam losses, where we lost to Wales, Scotland, Ireland, and then France, all in big Grand Slam deciders, won every other game, and it never happened. For 4 years, it didn't happen. And we'd all been through those things. And by the time we got to the World Cup final, also having almost lost to Samoa, and then Wales in the quarterfinal, and then having a guy that keeps kicking goals to put us back into a tie for the World Cup final when we're that close to lifting the cup. When he kicked the last goal, you look at the guys' faces, and there is no resistance anymore. It's just literally like, it's almost flipping it the other way around. It becomes your favour, because those guys, I think, and me as well, were thinking, I don't want him to miss this last kick, because we don't want to win this World Cup because their guy missed the kick. We want to win it. We don't want to not lose it, or to have it not won against us almost. And as a result, when it went over, everyone just moved as one to the halfway line in total understanding, total togetherness, and in the most complete, I think, performance in terms of dealing or thriving in a time-restricted, I'm not going to say pressure, but time-restricted situation against an incredible challenge, incredible opposition. We made something happen that was remarkable.
Yeah.
Purely because all of those guys had no resistance to the fact he's kicking. In fact, actually, they said, we want to be, we want the unexpected, because if we get what we want the whole time, we're not going to grow. And at that point, the guys were like, let's see how we can grow from this. Yeah. Let's see what we can do next, as opposed to, please just give us what we want. It was like, no, keep challenging us and we'll keep seeing what we've got. And in the end, we show essentially what that whole 5-year period had been about.
Just to touch on the resistance then, just to pick up on that point. So yeah, the resistance to what happens causes a lot of stress and disquiet in a lot of people. So it's accepting what is.
It is, definitely. I think there's so many different ways of explaining it. I think, and for me, what it means ultimately is that if I'm resisting, I think this is how I live my life now, is that those, anything I get from resistance, which is much, 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 much less than it's ever been, but whatever resistance I feel, it's not coming from me now. It's coming from an old version of me that's telling me now how to live my life. And whatever an old version of me thought wasn't acceptable, this version of me now, right now, can accept anything. And that battle, resistance for me, has only ever been things working against each other. We mentioned about the gut and the brain. If they're not working in tandem, they're ever so slightly not working together, maybe working slightly against each other in some ways, you get stress. That's two forces working against each other. Now, pressure and all those things for me is, at the time, if you asked me when I was younger, I wrote a book when I was just after the World Cup because I was injured and they sort of said, would you like to write a book? So I wrote one, and you read it, it's just black and white. It's just telling people how they should live their lives and what's right and wrong. What's good and bad. And now that whole me was plagued by thoughts of pressure, stress and fear of failure. And all that came out of my mouth at that time was a verbalization of that. I then live in a world now where I understand that if I don't have the thought, what if this goes wrong for me? Without that thought, there is no pressure. If I come in here to do this interview with you and I think, what if it doesn't go well? Now it's like, oh, and I'm under pressure. I've got to get this right. But if I don't have that thought, there's no pressure. It's not that there is pressure or there isn't. It's without that thought, there's not. But that thought, what if it goes wrong for me, doesn't help my performance. Mm-hmm. Because my performance is at its best when I'm effortless, light, connected. And that thought creates stress, fear, and tension. So that thought is working against me. Now, if my mind's working against me, then I have resistance and mental health. And as a result, my whole life has been about, like I said, realigning so that everything is working as one to make sure that I can be however I want to be, to make the most of every second. And in those days, my story was, I'm really important, which means I'm always under pressure, I'm always stressed, and you can tell how important I am because of how stressed I am and how fearful I am, is because I want it more than you. But actually, as soon as the whistle goes, a brilliant analogy that everyone uses, not uses, just a truth it seems for everyone, that in the changing room, oh, I hate it, it's so tough just before the game, I can't bear it and all this, but when the whistle goes, I'm fine. The understanding for me was that when I was in the changing room, I was trying to live in the future. When the whistle goes, that version of me in that moment then just realizes I've always been capable. But when you live in the now, you're always capable. When you try to live in the future, you feel helpless because I'm not equipped now to know the future.
Of course not.
And that's what everyone does in the change rooms. I need to know how this goes. I need to know it goes well. And all it does is creates an internal environment that wrecks you. So people often say to me, do you think you'd have played better if you'd have had this mindset back when you played? And the answer is, this is the only mindset I ever had when I played. It's just in between the games, I somehow created a world of stress and pressure.
Yeah.
Same way you look at a kicker now, they're playing beautifully in the game. The referee puts his arm up and says, penalty, you're going to kick a goal. And you watch the behavior of the kicker all of a sudden. He goes from being totally absorbed and engaged and involved to suddenly, oh God, here we go, stress, pressure. Because it's not because the kick is more pressure than the action they've just been doing. It's because they've got time to now think, what if this goes wrong for me? What if I let the team? All those thoughts, which don't help, because just a minute before, they're beautifully engaged. They're doing incredible things without thinking. And now they've got a bit of time to think. I had time to think between my games, and I used that time to do anything but prepare myself for the game. I did the opposite. I stressed the hell out of my body. I messed my mind up all over the place. And then I went in, the whistle went. I went, oh, God, life's great. And I then made up this idea that all that stress led to that beautiful moment. So I stressed some more, thinking that it would bring some more beauty at the end of it. And it kind of ended up doing the opposite.
Yeah. So it's buying into that story. And that thought, you know, what if this goes wrong? Obviously, it was extreme in your case and extreme in the case of elite athletes like your teammates, you know, wanting to know how the match is going to go. But everyone can relate to that. And it is a very debilitating thought, isn't it? It stops people doing things because, like you say, they imagine a future, and an imaginary future can be pretty overwhelming. But actually, the reality of it, the present very rarely is something we can't deal with.
Well, I think the absolute present has already been dealt with. It's already being dealt with. So when you're saying the present is... It's always the thought of what's next, and the absolute present has already been dealt with. One of the guys that I think you mentioned, we have some people in common that we follow. One of his expressions was that this moment now is inevitable. That's it. And now, because it's inevitable, it's already been dealt with. It's here now,
yeah.
and coming to that understanding then allows you to make the next moment something far more incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as for me, it's a really good representation of that whistle. When the whistle goes on a rugby field, you just let go.
Yeah.
And that moment at the end of 2003, 1 second before it, if you'd have said, stop, just think about this moment now, yeah. I'd have fallen on the floor, I'd have picked my knees up, hugged them to my chest and just rolled around on the floor being like, take me out of here. Because I can't deal with the implication, the apparent consequences of this and the what if this and what if that. It would have destroyed me. As it was, on that field, when you're in that moment, you let go and allow, and whatever it's supposed to be. Now, all that training, all the preparation beforehand then allows you to be ready.
Yeah.
The mind didn't allow me to be ready for that at all. It was my mind let go and allowed me just to be. And then, the all the work and all the dreams and all the desires just came into being. Like I said, it's the one moment on a field where I have very little experience of what happened apart from observing it.
I wanted to ask you about that very quickly. The quote that you came, was that Rupert Spira?
No, that was Sadhguru one.
Sadhguru, yeah. Right, okay. You mentioned there, so 2003, that moment, you've described the infamous moment where you kicked the goal and brought a tear to my eye and many other people's, as almost observing yourself, there being that sense of Johnny isn't here, it just happens, and a kind of peace came over you. So, yeah, can you just describe what that was like then?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think it's sort of going on my recollection from what was quite a long time ago now, unfortunately. I got more and more involved as the play went on. So from the line out, I was stood before the line out waiting for the ball, waiting for the ball to be thrown in. So there's that kind of like, geez, can we just get on with this kind of feeling? And the ball came to me and I gave it to Mike Catt, ran in, and then I'm sort of moving around to see what happens next. And at that point, I'm starting to get a bit more involved and thinking, well, hold on, we're not going anywhere here. Am I going to have a long drop goal from way back here? The guys are trying to get into position, take it up. Matt Dawson makes a break. As we're chasing him down the field, you're getting more and more involved. the crowd are picking up. Suddenly I'm looking now, instead of thinking, am I going to hit my drop goal? I'm now thinking, where can I go to score the try? Can I help Matt Dawson here or whatever? Then the guys start going to the next rack and the next rack. And now I've lost that sense of, do I need to kick a drop goal? What am I going to do? And I'm now watching just what's happening. You know, Neil Back passes the ball to Martin Johnson, takes the ball. And I'm watching Martin Johnson. I'm looking at him thinking, I'm watching every move he makes. Is he going to get the ball back? How's he done that? How's he done that? Where are the guys coming from? I see Matt Dawson get into place and I'm stood there. And again, I'm not thinking about the drop goal. I'm now just stood watching Matt Dawson thinking, here comes the ball. I'm feeling the ball hit my hands. I'm no longer thinking I've got a drop goal to do. I'm just feeling the ball. And then I set the ball down, drop it. And as it drops, I see it drop and the ball turns ever so slightly towards me and forwards. Ever so slightly. If it goes too far towards me, it'll change the kick completely, but it's gone just a tiny bit, which means I'm going to miss the sweet spot of the ball. I can sense this the whole time. I'm going to miss the sweet spot of the ball, but I'll catch it just underneath and just around the and on a small solid point of the ball, which means it'll spin a lot quicker. It'll go a lot shorter, but it'll be a hell of a lot straighter. And so as it drops between the legs, I can feel my leg going back, but it's not me kicking it. It's a knowing of it. And as I hit the ball, the sensation is what I thought it was, you know, almost what I knew it was going to be. And I'm watching the ball go and it's tracing a line. And it's only when the ball gets halfway through the other side, so it's a few yards past the other side of the post, that I then realise what the hell's happened. And then me kicks in, yeah. All of a sudden you comes back. And I do this half-hearted sort of celebration, which is almost just disbelief because I haven't been there to really see it. And now I've come out of it to try and celebrate it, which I then stop myself knowing that these guys in the golden shirts have gotten back into this game so many times, and if anyone's capable of doing it, they are. So I'm now running around going, just catch the damn kickoff and get this ball off the field now, you know, let's finish this job. But yeah. It was a sense of deeper and deeper involvement, which led it to be not a memory that I treasure because I don't have that much memory of it, but just an experience which gave me a glimpse, if you like, of life a little bit outside the boundaries of what I thought was possible.
A glimpse of reality.
A glimpse of, yeah, something bigger, yeah.
Now, obviously, so 2003, as we've established, I've left that sweary answer phone message. Mm-hmm. You know, you've hugged Will Greenwood. He got the shot. Everyone's happy. You've lifted the trophy. There's a picture of you walking down the tunnel with all these arms towards you and you've got your head bowed and you're going off. And obviously, you know, you'd convince yourself that the stress led to the performance.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
But then you spoke about not long after being kind of as empty as you'd ever been.
I think that's it. Just from a sort of society perspective, you're in a way a little bit promised this idea that at the end of this suffering will come the joy, you know, whether it's the next car, whether it's the job, whether it's the family, whether it's the retirement. I think it's quite interesting now because life's added, or the mind's added another one now, which stops you ever facing this because it says, well, after I'm gone, my legacy will make me happy. You're kind of like, oh, now I'm screwed. I'm never gonna face this in my lifetime. But the idea that all this doing will end in being is something that's, I think, embedded a little bit in society over here. The idea that becoming someone will reveal all your potential. Mm-hmm. You know, what I acquire in my life is going to give me potential. Almost like there is actual potential in a World Cup that you lift. You know, that it has this almost source of energy that when you lift it, you get embedded with this joy. I mean,
like He-Man's sword.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and it didn't work that way for me. And I was so pleased to have gotten to that stage early enough to realise that, geez, you know, if it's not there, then surely maybe my potential is actually in me. And I should look that way. And it's kind of like the obvious thing of, you know, what you're looking for is where you're looking from type idea, that you sort of end up going, well, I've got to start maybe understanding that I started off this life as a young kid who just wanted to know all I could be. And I've become a guy that just wants to have everything, have the reputation, have the status, have the cup, have the life and the whatever. And when I had it all, I was like, oh, geez, I've stopped being all I can, trying to be all I can be, and I've started trying to control the world to have this amazing thing. And it was, you know, the next morning it kicked in. You wake up and, you know, you sort of, it's not, you know, we're waiting for that big change. You're waiting for, you know, whatever it is to...
Euphoria, yeah.
And it just wasn't there. But dangerous is that habit is that, you know, suddenly I started thinking, well, I'll tell you why it's not there. It's because we haven't won two in a row.
Yeah.
So we need to get busy on 2007. And sure enough, we almost got there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Still, but even so, yeah, like I said, that drive is amazing. The drive is, and the single focus is so powerful. But the energy behind it, when you're doing it out of passion and excitement between the two whistles, it's beautiful. When you're doing it out of stress and need, and it has to be, you know, or else, what if I let some? It can be the most debilitating and destructive thing.
Yeah,
you can experience.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. You know, you were fortunate to experience that at 24 and learn the lesson, because we can see in the world a lot of people do get stuck on the accumulation world, and it's never enough. You know, there's a lot of that goes around, but clearly you're someone who wants to learn the lessons. So after 2003, and between you again and your trusty boots steering England to the 2007 final, you had this unbelievable period where you robbed England fans of, you were robbed of just so many appearances by all the injuries. Now, two questions around this. First of all, to what degree were those injuries born of the pressure that, you know, the internal pressure cooker that you were self-creating? And second of all, you've said they were too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence. So to what degree were they inevitable? And then also, it sounds like you learnt a lot of lessons from that period.
Yeah, there's many ways I can explain this. And the inevitability of those injuries comes from the fact that I was so stressed at that time. Working my mind and body, working against each other, working against themselves in so many different ways. I had my neck operation, the first one I had. Was out. I knew I was going to be out for the whole entire year, 11 months I was out. I knew I was going to be out for at least 9. And the day after the operation with the neck brace on, I was on a bike. Just because my head was telling me, you've got to get back to where you were. If not, it's a failure. And what if you never get back? So get out and do this. Now my body is trying to go, just let me heal. I've been under surgery for 7 hours or whatever, you know, and I've just come out. Just let me get healing. And as it was, I'm going, my mind is saying, no, I know what's better. Let's do this out of fear of what else. And so, yeah, I got all those injuries, 14 or whatever injuries in a row, because my body just didn't heal. But at the same time, early on, I felt probably like I was, you know, if you caught me on a bad day, I'd have said this cost me, you know, potentially maybe 40, 50 games for England, and imagine what could have been. On a good day, I'd have told you, geez, you know, this has opened my eyes to so many bigger things. It's been incredible, and I'd never wish it away.
Yeah.
In a global sense, well, the most incredible thing about that was one day I looked at it and thought, well, this is ludicrous. How can I have two stories for the same past? Which one of them's true? And the answer is, I realized neither. There is no story to the past. And this was the most revelationary thing, understanding that I'm not a result of what I've been through. What I've been through is a result of how I am now. And my life then became about exploring who I can be now. And as a result, past and whatever has changed for me. It's become a glorious memory opportunity. It's not become a solid past that sticks me in a certain place and tells me this is who I am and therefore this is how it has to be.
And so it's dropping away of the identity.
Hugely, just because I got to the stage where I looked at it and thought, well, when I'm in a good mood, apparently I live by the thing of saying that who I am is a result of everything I've been through. Uh-huh. But when I was in a good mood, I'd tell you a completely different story to when I was in a bad mood.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, hold on, this is ridiculous. Surely the cause can't keep changing, but the effects stay the same. So I've realized that maybe I've gotten the wrong way around.
Yeah.
The cause and the source is me right now. You know, the effect is actually what then, you know, the past has to realign to fit where I want to go now. And my future has to realign to fit what it is I suddenly want to achieve today. And,
yeah.
You know, that was perhaps the biggest part that came out of all that injury, was just there was a bit of a deeper sense of understanding that, you know, I didn't want to be a product anymore. Yeah, I always spoke about being a leader and whatever, but my whole ethos in life was that I was being influenced. The environment and others and everyone else influenced how I was. And then I wanted to influence others. It was like me speaking about leadership was a farce. So I thought, oh, I've got to get serious about this and find out if I'm going to lead, I've got to go somewhere new. And if I'm going to go somewhere new, I've got to challenge myself.
So that period, how low were you?
I was low, but my lowest points were actually not always in rugby.
Yeah.
Because of the whatever, the obsessive side and this mind working against it, myself or whatever, I'd had experiences off the field that were far deeper and far more sort of challenging. But on the field, you know, without that sort of purpose, and when you're a result of everything you've been through, and now all of a sudden your values that tell you what's good, bad and successful are now turning in on you, saying, well, look at you, just sat here at home doing nothing. Well, all the guys are out there achieving stuff on the field. You're not even going to the gym. You're not achieving. It's just falling away. You know, you're a waste of time. All these things turned in on me with an intensity that aligned with my obsessive nature. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I wasn't going to let that go. You know, I wanted to explore just what a waste of time I was. So I went there. Yeah, and this, like I said, that was all packaged as part of the deal.
So that became part of your identity as well?
Yeah, just being harsh on myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, not yeah, and so as many people talk about with the depression side that comes with it, is that you're locked in a cell, but yeah, outside the cell is the prison guard, and it's you, and you're holding the key, and therefore there's no way you're getting out, because it's not someone you can convince and say, you know, I'm actually a good guy, because the guy out there is telling you, no, I know exactly who you are, and you're staying in there. It's where you deserve to be, and so you need permission to let yourself out, and yeah, that was a really, really interesting time, and at that moment there's nothing more important than immediate support.
Yeah,
you know, whether it be family and whether it be friends, and I had these, and so I had that support in spades, or whether it be, you know, getting out there and starting on the road to, you know, to create an environment where you're not getting better, but you're getting ready.
Yeah.
To get better.
Were you able to communicate with this, your support network? Were you able to be open with them about what was going on?
I just couldn't go below the surface of it.
Right.
Everything I articulated at the time was just talking about how I needed the world to change for me to be different.
Yeah.
Because I was a product of the environment. So I needed the environment to change so I could be a different product. And as a result, what would the readiness for me to get better came from after it had been, you know, I don't know, 9 months or whatever. It just sort of started to hit me that I suddenly, for whatever reason, I understood that it's me that needs to change.
Yeah. So you had this aha moment. Now, we won't go into too much detail about Schrodinger's cat, but do Google it, because it's a bit of a mad thought experiment. But you had this aha moment where you realized that you were creating your own reality.
Yeah, I guess maybe I wasn't as deep as that at the time. I just realized that if I want my world to change,
the world that has to change.
Yeah, maybe it's me. Yeah. I didn't know how much of the world was in me, and that journey's been, you know, continues to sort of to evolve. But for me, it was just that understanding that, you know what, I've got to explore some of these apparent truths that I hold about life and about me. And when I did start exploring them on this journey, the last thing I ever came up against has been a truth. I've never found anything solid. Yeah, I turned around and looked for myself and sort of said, come on, you know, to this me, and said, you've been driving me like mad. You've been having your opinion on me. You've been telling me what's good, bad, and how I'm a waste of time. So come on, let's meet, you and me. And I'm like, you're a no-show.
Yeah, nowhere to be found.
You're a no-show, yeah, exactly. And so it's like, well, hold on. What else isn't here? And as a result, you know, the journey sort of took me into a space that seemed to be going in a different direction to a lot of those around me who were sort of, you know, were finding it hard to understand what I was doing in my life at that time.
So it is. So you were bound upright, and you've spoken about the identity of humble Johnny. So, you know, was an element of, you know, you have to speak to people for 2 minutes. You have to be respectful. And, you know, everyone was, you know, I think had fallen for that part of you. But you realised that even that, you know, was an identity that you were holding on to, that you could just let go of.
Yeah, I think it was more, no matter how much I tried to get away from it, everything had the sense that there was a payoff coming. So by being, spending time with people, I love spending time with people, but there was this sense that by doing it, there's a payoff coming. And that payoff was, people are going to think this way about me, and for some reason that makes me a better person. And the payoff was always, if I do this, and I'm willing to, and I loved it, don't get me wrong, I loved it, and I love speaking to people, but it was probably, the overriding factor was, you know, they won't believe it if I stay behind for 3 hours after a game and sign autographs.
Really?
Or, yeah, or you won't believe it if I, you know, if you know, I kind of almost that sense of, yeah, I'm doing my 2 or 3 hours kicking on a day, whatever, wrecking my body, but, and I'm thinking, I love doing this, but then when someone starts watching in the crowd, I'm thinking, oh, they're going to see how hard I work. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's always this payoff of what other people think or whatever else is coming is going to make me a better person, make me happy, or essentially be my saving grace. And I guess it was, yeah, the interviews or whatever, when you finish an interview and afterwards you have that sense that it was a good interview as opposed to it just being you.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess, the difference between, yeah, the absolute involvement of them in the moment or the doing it because there's a better moment coming.
Yeah.
You know, if I get through this, you won't believe what I'm going to get at the end of it, as opposed to, yeah, now I spend 2 or 3 hours talking to people and they want to get away. I'm the one that speaks to them because I just want to interact. I want to connect to people.
Yeah.
I spend time doing things that I love doing, or even things that I don't necessarily love doing. I spend time doing them because I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
I'm curious about everything. I'm absolutely intrigued by everything. Whereas before, the intrigue level was a little bit lower because the level of, whoa, imagine what will happen if this happens, was in there. The payoff, the big payoff coming, which again, I had to check myself and say, I've been here before.
Yeah.
There isn't one coming that, you know, if I'm having a bad day, it doesn't matter if, you know, so many people are out there liking me. Doesn't matter. It's not about, you know, I'm not a result of other people's thoughts.
Yeah.
I'm just not a product. And yeah, so I keep coming back to it, but it's a lot of my time was doing the right thing instead of just being me and exploring that the right thing is already in all of us, I think.
So yeah, your obsessiveness played out in this trying to control things, including the way other people saw you.
Yeah.
And in letting go of that control, is that how you found peace?
I think letting go of control is essentially the only way to have total control, but not in a sort of
controlling way.
Yeah. But more in a sense of revealing your ability to respond. You know, is for me comes from exploring. Yeah, and that means, as why I say, you know, the challenges for me are always going to send me into that space of, wow, look what I do actually have the ability to respond to. So, yeah, I sort of speak to some of the guys with the kickers that were involved in this, is to say, you know, in the change room before the game, sometimes you catch yourself thinking, I hope this team haven't travelled well. I hope they're not, you know, they're playing some of their second string team or you know, they've decided they're going to save themselves for next week or whatever. But actually, you change that round, going back to the England final when the boys, I think, were actually keen for Elton Flatley to kick that last goal. I think it's the same in the change room. You look around and go, I hope, like anything, that these guys bring their best game. And I hope that my opposite number has an absolute stormer. Why? Because I want to be challenged. I want to find out what I'm capable of. So I don't want what I want.
Yeah.
I don't want what I expect. And I think, you know, I think that's been for me quite a big part of that. You know, you sort of letting go of control, I'd say more, you know, allowing or
not resisting.
Yeah, allowing it and accepting, yeah.
You talked as well about that period where you had all the injuries and that you had a lesson that had to be learned. And one for you was about balance, which you were just out of whack. Is that true?
Yeah, like I said, I think from a balance perspective, it was coming back to the idea that it's not a case of finding balance as so much, balance is already here.
Right.
It's here and now.
So don't tinker with it.
It's just, but it's back to that same part about just allowing things to be. The balance is already here. I think trying to balance a million different things, it's hard enough just trying to balance two. You live just with one other person in your house, and you think, well, it's just, you just get a dog, and you think, well, I've only got a dog, I should be able to balance this, your life becomes an absolute no, just because you're trying to balance someone else. Whereas if you just look deeper into yourself, then the balance is already there. I think, I guess the lessons idea was interesting, because I think that you make up your own lessons to learn. It just depends on what direction you want to go. And for me, when I was younger, I had every lesson I learned was helpful to achieving things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the losing 76-0 to Australia was a massive lesson in how to achieve the World Cup, but it wasn't a lesson in how to reveal the best of me.
Yeah,
it was, all things can be an incredible lesson in how to get what you want. They're not necessarily the same lessons that end in, you know, in that kind of more peaceful, joyful and inspired state.
A quote of yours I like: the beauty of being alive is never arriving. And that kind of touches on what we're talking about here, isn't it? This idea, you know, we're always looking to arrive, and in doing so, many people never live. That's what a lot of people say. And the beauty of life is understanding that it is impermanent.
Yeah, I think a good way to sort of sum up, my last game was with Toulon in France, and we had a European Cup final followed by a League Cup final. And no team in France had ever done the double, and we won the European Cup final. My final game ever of my career was going to be this final. So, excuse me, I had a few nerves going on before the game, and yeah, quite sort of like, yeah, really keen to get out there and make this a big performance and do whatever's possible. And walking around the field at the end, holding that they call it the Brennus, it's the world's biggest shield, it's incredibly heavy. Walking around the field, speaking to the incredible supporters that we had in the Stade de France or whatever, geez, it was an incredible moment. But I'd have swapped it in an instant to be back on that field 1 minute before the end of the game. And this is the point, it happened with the World Cup final as well. Just the referee on his putting the whistle to his mouth, I'd have swapped it for that moment just before the ball crossed the line when Mike Catt smashed it off the field. Mm. This, for me, has been one of my biggest sort of findings along the journey, is that I'm never going to arrive at who I am, and life's done that for me. As much as I think I've arrived there, the thing is I'm never ever going to arrive at who I am, and that's why it's such an amazing feeling to be alive, because I can keep exploring.
Yeah,
it's only up to me if I suddenly decide I'm at the end of that journey, because I am who I am. I'm a result of my past, and therefore this is who I am. And then all of a sudden, I've now got to control everything around me to maintain my happiness, instead of realizing that, you know what, I'm on this amazing journey of realizing that when I'm 95 years old, I'm still not going to be anyone.
No.
But I'll still be just thinking about who I could be.
Yeah. Where is happiness to be found? Is it then in being present, which in another way of putting it is in loving the process?
Right. I think happiness and whatever and joy and those kind of things are interesting.
Yeah.
I think where they're found is in being alive and exploring what that really means. I spoke to someone recently who's playing rugby and was told, you know, you need to be more, you know, more enjoyment while you're playing. And the danger is you walk around thinking that, well, if I just smile when I'm playing rugby, then I'll be enjoying myself. And I'm like, how does that feel when you're trying to do that? It feels the worst I've ever felt. Well, what does joy mean to you?
Yeah.
It's when I'm just fully engaged in what I'm doing.
Present,
alive, inspired in a way, going somewhere new, yeah, going somewhere into space where you haven't been before, excited, opportunity, connecting to people, which is why people often say happiness is in friends and family. It's like, well, but when people start to become friends and they feel like family, that's an incredible connection, yet everyone can become friends and family if you're willing to go deep enough. Do you know what I mean? It's like, for me, it's in everywhere, but it's in exploring. I believe, from my own experience, the one thing I can truly say is that I've never controlled my way to my potential or happiness.
Johnny Wilkinson, it's been an absolute joy having you on Don't Tell Me the Score. Thank you very much indeed for
pleasure.
Coming in.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me the Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. And I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas, and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening. And if you could leave a kind rating and review,
I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.